The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Welcome to 2019. My name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Rich.
So I almost said Lionel Burney there, but we're not with Lionel Burney.
Where is Napalm
this week? He is in Calpe in southern Spain at the team, I've given myself a challenge already. The team formerly known as Quick Step, their training camp, and he will be reporting.
De Koenig? I haven't practiced this. One of the things that
Lionel will be doing there is establishing exactly how to pronounce the new sponsor, De Koenig. It sounds good to me. I could get used to that. So we're going to hear from him actually in a moment. He's going to have a news roundup and a brief report from De Koenig Quick Step before next week's bumper edition from Calpe. But Daniel, well, Happy New Year, Daniel.
Happy New Year, Rich.
Let's get formalities out of the way.
I should know this. Is that now? Is that around about now?
Hogmanay is...
Yeah, with my Scottish heritage, I should know
well,
this.
Well, Hogmanay is the 31st of December.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And...
But there was the other one. There's another one, isn't there? There's another thing coming. A Scottish thing.
Early in January.
Burns Night. That's
Burns
it.
Burns Night.
When's
25th
that?
Of January. 25th of January. That's annual festival where we eat a lot of haggis, neeps and tatties to commemorate Robert Burns, the national poet.
Played by Mel Gibson, famously, of course.
Oh, God, oh,
no, that's,
please.
That's a different one.
William Wallace.
That's
he a wasn't a poet.
One. What about Rob Roy?
Oh, dear.
Who was Rob
Terrible.
Roy?
Rob Roy was another kind of warrior, freedom fighter, shall we call him.
Well, Rich, I don't need to know about any of this until Scotland declares independence, and then I can
an interesting non-cycling start. Back to cycling, Daniel. You ended the year attending team training camps, and you began this year at a team training camp, didn't you?
Well, not exactly a training camp, but a team...
A presentation. Yeah.
Yes. It was Sunweb's presentation in Berlin. I think the fourth year in a row they've held their presentation in Berlin. Just
an annual fixture for you as well.
It is. I was able to walk to the presentation. It was snowing. Pretty grim part of Berlin, I must say, that they choose to do their presentation. And they were actually also off to, I think, Calpe or maybe Denia, somewhere in Spain for their training camp. The men's team was at least the following day. So they all congregated in Berlin and then were getting on a flight to Spain.
Great. And it was we're going to be hearing a bit from that later in the episode. You spoke to Tom Dumoulin, his coach, and Nicholas Roach, among others. What was the atmosphere like at the team?
It was pretty good, Rich. They've got a natty new jersey. I notice people get very exercised, don't they, about jerseys, and particularly national champions jerseys in the off season. I suppose it's one of the few things that cycling fans have to talk about in the sort of dead periods over Christmas. But people get very angry, don't they, Rich?
Do you? You're famously, Daniel, not very attached to the idea of nationality and patriotism and so on. So I imagine that the issue of national champions jerseys isn't one that exercises you a great deal.
No, not terribly. Should distinguish between patriotism and nationalism, of course, two different things. But
I didn't
I'm
say
not very nationalistic.
To be clear,
but no, it's something that I don't. Well, the jersey thing is something that I don't. It doesn't really cause me any sleepless nights. What about you?
Do you not appreciate a really classic kind of national champions jersey? De Koenig do it very well. FDJ do it very well. Where they just give over the jersey to the flag. The Italian national champions jersey is particularly striking, as is the French, I think.
Actually, now that I think about it, I'm about to contradict myself and say that, yes, I do very much, or I did very much appreciate, for example, the Mappe Swiss national champions jersey worn by Oscar Kamenzin in 1998. Thought was fantastic. Just red background with white cross. And yeah, like you say, when a nice big Italian tricolour. The one that baffles me, always baffles me slightly, and I always think it's a bit of a missed opportunity, is the British national champions jersey, which could easily be confused with a Dutch or even, in the right light, a Luxembourgish national champions jersey.
Would you? The Union Jack though is a little. It's a bit busy, isn't it, for a jersey?
I remember Jeremy Hunt used to have a albeit small Union Jack on his Benesto kit. In the late 90s when he was national champion.
The US national champion, Corn Rivera, was there for Sunweb, of course. That tends to be, can be more stylishly done. Famously, of course, Larry Warbass had a very nice US national champions jersey when he was at Aqua Blue Sport. It can be done quite well. You'd think the British one could be done in a similar sort of way, but it's a very simple, you know, predominantly white with red and blue bands. I quite like it, actually, just for the simplicity of it. But it's good to get the year started with you arguing with yourself already. Dion, disagreeing with yourself, that's fantastic. We are going to return to Team Sunweb a little bit later on and hear your interviews from there. But shall we cross over to Napalm and Kalpi and get a news roundup from him? Here is Lionel Burney.
Yeah, thanks, Rich. Hello from Calpe in Spain, where the sun has now set and the sea is lapping on the very quiet, out-of-season beach. And I'm sitting in the not-too-freezing cold here, having been to the De Koenig Quickstep team presentation and launch. Very good effort there on the pronunciation of De Koenig. They make
Thank
windows.
Thank you. Nice to hear it. Nice to hear it confirmed.
Yeah, well, I asked the boss of De Koenig, and he said he didn't really care how anyone pronounces it, as long as they buy his windows and doors and patio doors and garden office type windows and doors that they make. So I guess if he's happy with me mangling it for the season, then I shall do my best.
Yeah, well, they will be Quickstep, won't they? Won't be so happy with that, but anyway.
No, well, Quickstep have just bumped back down to the second spot in the hierarchy of sponsors for Patrick Lefebvre's team. A long-running relationship, that, pushing 20 years. Well, they're still involved. But yeah, De Koenig, Quickstep, we'll have to get used to that as the season unfolds. And, well, that's going to be very soon, isn't it? Because the Tour Down Under starts next week. The World Tour crashes back into action with the first race of the season, and well, there is already some racing that's been happening in Australia, the national championships in particular. A couple of interesting stories from those championships, because do you remember Michael Freiberg winning the Omnium World Championships in Apeldoorn in 2011? I was there. He was a young rider, part of the Aussie Endurance group. Didn't get selected for the Olympics, I don't think, in 2012, and then drifted out of cycling. And he's invented a training system, which some of the top pros use. He's back. He's come back to cycling in 2017, and he won the road race over the weekend. But he hasn't been selected for the Aussie team, the UNISA team, for the Tour Down Under, so he's a bit disappointed about that, but he will be riding the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Race.
Meanwhile, in the women's road race at the Aussie Nationals, there was a stunning and perhaps surprising win for 18-year-old Sarah Giganti, who beat the World Championship silver medalist Amanda Spratt by 50 seconds. Last season, Giganti broke both of her arms in a crash during a race. This was by far the biggest victory of her career so far, and although she doesn't have a professional contract yet, it surely will only be a matter of time.
In the time trial, Rowan Dennis's 3-year run as Aussie Time Trial Championship has come to an end. Luke Durbridge won that. Dennis does have the considerable compensation of wearing the rainbow jersey this year, though, so I'm not sure he'd be too disappointed. A couple of bits of news from our friends at Gazzetta dello Sport. One is that Trek Segafredo want to sign Vincenzo Nibali when his current Bahrain Merida deal ends at the end of this season. But Bahrain Merida's manager Brent Copeland is quoted by Gazzetta saying that they are already in the process of offering Nibali a 2-year deal to keep him on the team. Another story that Gazzetta reported is rumours swirling around Team Sky, and Gazzetta say that Comcast, which is Sky's new owners, are committed to cover 70% of the team's budget for 2020 and 2021. Whether that would be enough for Dave Brailsford to carry on with the team, or whether it would enable them to bring in another sponsor just to top the budget up to the level that he is accustomed to, we will have to wait and see. Meanwhile, Sylvain Adams, the owner of the Israel Cycling Academy and the man who basically took the Giro d'Italia to Israel last year, has also suggested to Velo News that he'd be interested in a merger with Team Sky. As you'd expect, Team Sky are being very tight-lipped about all of this at the moment. And finally, we've already had the first doping story of 2019, and it's a pretty quirky one because 90-year-old Carl Grove from Bristol, Indiana, tested positive for a banned steroid and a fertility drug when winning the 90 to 94 age group in the time trial sprint and individual pursuit at the US Masters Track Nationals last year. Now, the thing about this is that he was the only competitor in his category.
Last man standing.
Yeah, doping to win a race only you can win is a stretch even for cycling. USADA accepts that one of the substances may have come from some tainted meat that he'd eaten, and the other was from a supplement he'd taken which didn't list any banned substances on the packaging. Nevertheless, it does look like Carl Grove will lose his titles. But, well, rules are rules, I guess.
Interesting one, isn't it, that one? Because, you know, I think most people will look at that and go, he's clearly, you know, something's gone wrong there. You would imagine he's not set out to cheat himself. You know, and there's a double standard, I think, there, because had it been a young rider in his prime, a top rider, it would have been, you know, described as another kind of dog ate my homework type story. But it maybe shows that you know, mistakes or, you know, things like that can actually happen.
Well, the alternative is that he looked at the start sheet, saw that he was the only man on the list, and thought, well, I'd better not take too many chances here. I'd better make sure, you know. I think that's quite unlikely that he would, you know.
Into the realms of speculation here already,
well,
Lionel.
But the thing is, you know, again, I mean, I suppose this is a bit of a daft thing to say, but, you know, USADA, you know, we know the budgets for anti-doping efforts are incredibly stretched and under a lot of pressure. But I guess if you're going to have races that are run under all of the rules, then you have to, if you're going to be doing random testing, you have to test people in the 90 to 94 years old age category as well, I guess.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor. Again, our third full year with Rafa. Very grateful to them for their support. It really does enable us to, well, plan the program that we've got this year, which will include, again, all the grand tours and lots of other things besides. Rafa have a big event coming up this weekend in Australia, where the kit for the new Education First, EF Education First team will be unveiled. Their riders, some of them have been competing already and riding and training in black, so it's been kept under wraps, the new kit. And well, I mean, Rafa do produce nice kit. I mean, the Canyon SRAM kit is very nice indeed. That's the women's team, of course, and it really sets the bar in the women's side of the sport. So expectations fairly high, I would think, for the EF Education First kit unveil this weekend. You looking forward to that, Lionel?
I am. I'm not going to speculate on what it might look like, though. I'm going to just wait and see.
Be slightly underwhelming, wouldn't it, if it is just black? like the stuff they've been wearing.
That would be a great double bluff. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. Anyway, Lionel, before Daniel and I crack on with this week's podcast, which will be largely Sunweb themed, you are in Carpi. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you're doing there?
Well, yeah, I've come for a couple of days to the hotel that Patrick Lefebvre's team have used several times for their pre-season training camps. They had their team launch here as well. They've had that in Belgium in recent years, and Lefebvre was telling me that, you know, sometimes they have sort of 1,500 people turn up, and they were keener to have a sort of a slightly lower key launch this time round, just to rebalance the emphasis back to the training. Some of the riders weren't here because they were already on their way to Australia, and some on the way to South America for the first races of the season. I caught up with a few people at the team launch, Bob Jungels, who is going to be riding Cobble Classics, not Paris-Roubaix, but quite a lot of the other ones. He's not really ridden on the cobbles in Quickstep colours. He is, of course, an under-23 Paris-Roubaix winner. Did very well on the pavé stage at the Tour de France in the summer, finished seventh. So perhaps not a surprise that he's going to give the cobbles a bash. He's also going to ride the Giro again, go back to the Giro d'Italia. And when I sat down and talked to him, he talked me through the difficulties and the disappointments of his Tour de France, and that was quite interesting and quite revealing. We'll hear from Bob Jungels next week, I think. I also spoke to Yves Lampaert, the Belgian champion, about the weight of the Belgian champion's jersey on his shoulders, and also to the Czech rider, Petr Vakoč, who you may remember had a terrible accident in training where it was basically hit by a vehicle at about this time last year, I think, in South Africa, and basically wiped out his entire season. And at one point, he wasn't sure whether he would make a return. Patrick Lefebvre basically has given Vakoč a year's contract because his contract was actually up at the end of December. But because he didn't race at all last year and he's been working very hard to get back, the team have given him an opportunity and another year's contract. So we will also hear from him at some point, maybe next week as well. And something else, I sat down this morning for quite a long chat with Lefebvre himself. Very interesting. Initially it was going to be a lunch with, but things got all changed about a bit, so it ended up being coffee with Lefebvre this morning.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by The Economist, and you can get a free print copy of The Economist by texting the word cycling to 78070. Now, The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, the arts, the environment, and even sport. The Economist sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story in a time when facts matter more than ever. It's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. Now, Richard, you've been reading The Economist this week. What's caught your eye?
Well, Lionel, much caught my eye in the first edition of The Economist of 2019, but the story I thought I'd mention grabbed my attention for the headline mainly. When hipsters ruled the world, it says. It's at the back in the books and arts section, and it's about how language changes, that certain words and phrases disappear. And we've known about this process, obviously, for forever, but it's one that seems to be accelerating quite rapidly. So expressions like instant message or poke, for example, in a Facebook context, barely used nowadays. And metrosexual, remember that, useful for about 5 minutes in 2003, says The Economist, to describe men who waxed, took care of their hair and so on. Metrosexual faded, not because it went out of date, but rather the opposite, because of the success of the underlying concept. Even though men started wearing beards and lumberjack shirts, they did so with exquisite care. Maybe not all of them. Every man is a metrosexual now, says The Economist. A hipster is in the same category, the article argues. Hipster culture is now so ubiquitous, there's scarcely any reason to notice it. Google searches for hipster, the word, peaked in America in 2011 and worldwide in 2015. Though, as the article says, using Google searches as a measure for when a word is fashionable is inaccurate. The people looking it up, by definition, don't know what it means, so they're behind the curve. The cool kids have already moved on to something else. Similarly, with the term woke, it seemed to move from compliment to jibe in a matter of just weeks. So it's all happening very quickly these days. But the conclusion for us at the Cycling Podcast is that hipsters are definitely out. Either that or they've taken over the world. You won't hear the term hipster on the podcast this year because it's so 2014.
The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, get your free print copy now by texting cycling to 78070. That's the word cycling to 78070.
Well, Simon Yates already almost won it last year. I think he made a few mistakes in the last week and he knows it and he will not make them again, I guess. So he's going to be a strong opponent, and Nibali, Roglic, Bernal. So it's going to be a hell of a fight. It's going to be a challenge, definitely. And I think my chances on being very good at the Tour de France are pretty low, especially with a week less. But last year I surprised myself already. I'm 1 year further, 1 year more experience, 1 year stronger. So I hope to surprise myself again in the Tour de France. And then we'll see about that. But yeah, the main focus will definitely be Giro, and then we'll see in the Tour de France, but I hope to do really well on both.
So we're played in there by, well, the familiar voice of Tom Dumoulin, and we'll hear a little bit more from him in a moment. But Daniel, that was Dumoulin talking about his ambitions for 2019 and his decision to focus on the Giro rather than Tour de France.
Yes, Rich, quite a, well, could we say contentious decision, or certainly a hotly debated, much talked about decision to prioritise the Giro again. One could argue that he's done that for the last 3 years. He is going to ride the Tour de France as well, but he made no bones really in Berlin at the Somewhere presentation about the fact that he hadn't appreciated the Tour de France route. That was unveiled in October. His original intention had been, and the team's intention had been, for Dumoulin to prioritise the Tour de France in 2019. And it stopped them in their tracks when they saw the Tour de France route. Specifically, what was it about the Tour route that they didn't like? Well, mainly the lack of time trialling. A 27-kilometre individual time trial is the only individual time trialling in the Tour de France this year in Po, that's going to be. There's a similar length team time trial that comes earlier in the race, but the Giro has a much larger slice of time trialing, which is obviously to Dumoulin's liking. There are two decent-sized time trials there, and the very exciting-looking first stage up the Madonna di San Luca climb in Bologna, which finishes, well, it's a very, very steep climb, isn't it? But that's, I think, over 8 kilometres, and that will already probably give Dumoulin a decent shot of taking the pink jersey pretty early in the Giro.
So shall we hear from Tom Dumoulin, the rest of your chat with him? Here is Dumoulin now.
Well, the decision wasn't made in Nepal, but the parkour of the Giro and Tour came out when I was in Nepal and a high mountain at 3,000 meters. And then I started thinking with my wife about it, like, oh, this, it was actually quite disappointing when I looked at the Tour parkour. I was at my honeymoon, but I still couldn't avoid checking my Twitter and just looking at the parkour. And I was a bit disappointed that because the focus, the plan was to fully focus on the Tour de France. And it made us really consider. So I send from the 3,000 meter altitude, I send the team a message like, don't decide anything yet. Let's talk about it first. And we did that. And eventually we still didn't know about afterwards, actually. And then the team made the final call to do this.
So there was Christian Prudhomme bragging about the highest Tour de France ever, and you at 3,000 metres looked at it and thought, no, it's not for me.
Yeah, that's a good summary, yeah.
Tell me a bit more about the trip to Nepal. Why did you want to go there and what did you do?
It was always a dream to... Well, I really like travelling to places that are very far off my comfort zone or something. And Nepal was like that, so yeah, it was cool.
Was that the highest you climbed, 3,000 meters, or did you do some really big mountains?
I went higher in training camp Sierra Nevada, actually. I went one time up to 3,200 or something, so I wasn't going in the highest, but it's possible to go much higher in Nepal, of course, but we avoided that.
And just from a technical, physiological point of view, Tom, we saw the figures that you released, the power data you released through Algemeen Dagblad. It was quite surprising the difference between the Giro and the Tour and how you seem to produce more power, the Giro even. I mean, how much does that sort of fit into your decision-making process as well?
I wouldn't take too much conclusion with only 1 year of those data. There could be various factors playing a role in those data. I mean, maybe the race was easier before the last climb because it was actually the data of the last climbs of the in the Giro and the Tour. But it could have been much harder in the Tour before with all the stress and with all the racing. So it's not to say that pushing a higher power in the last mountain of a stage in the Giro means that I was in better shape or was better there, and it's too easy to say that. Yeah.
Commercially, everyone is always surprised when you say, "Oh, I'm going to go to the Giro, and that's going to be my first priority." Everyone thinks that a Dutch sponsor will want you to go to the Tour and focus on that. Is there any pressure on you from that point of view?
Not on me, maybe on the team, but you have to ask Ivan about it. But I guess the sponsor also thinks like, okay, let's say I'm in top shape going to the Giro, let's say I'm in top shape going to the Tour. Maybe I would end up third in the Tour de France. It's very nice, very commercially interesting. But what would be commercially more interesting, winning the Giro or being third at the Tour? That is...
Even if on paper the fields and the levels look very similar in those two races, it doesn't look as though the Giro is much weaker than the Tour, harder.
No, definitely not with the opponents, but it's much better suited to my abilities, the course. That's the main reason. So my chances on winning it would be higher than in the Tour de France, we think. But still, winning one of them is extremely difficult, but yeah.
So Dumoulin there on honeymoon in Nepal, very adventurous, and that's where he learned about the Tour de France route and took the decision to focus on the Giro instead. And a lot of people, as you suggested earlier, Daniel, will be scratching their heads a bit at that because, you know, he was second at the Giro in 2018 and then also second at the Tour de France. And you felt that had he focused entirely on the Tour, it might have been there for the taking, perhaps, for him. I don't know. I mean, who knows? And he might have a similar, it might be a similar outcome this year where he's good at both races. Who knows? But I think people would like to see him put all his eggs in the Tour basket 1 year. And I think people kind of thought, well, if not this year, then when?
Yeah, absolutely, Rich. And it's difficult and interesting to sort of get a read on exactly what factors are prompting these decisions, not only on the part of Dumoulin, but and somewhere, but other teams and riders. I think I mentioned in the interview with him, I asked Tom Dumoulin about the power numbers that he submitted to one of the big Dutch newspapers over the winter, Algemeen Dagblad, and I found them pretty interesting in that they seem to suggest that the sort of gross level of the competition at the Giro last year was higher, in the sense that the wattage numbers, the power numbers on the final climbs tended to be a bit higher. And that's, as Tom Dumoulin said in the interview, a little bit misleading perhaps, but I think, you know, a lot of these decisions now are based on sort of physiological modelling of what exactly those two races and also the other major tour, the Vuelta, entail. I mean, I also spoke to Tom Dumoulin's coach, Hendrik Verne, we'll hear from him in a minute, about the sort of physiological factors which dictate that a rider will be more suited to one than the other and exactly how the two races differ. And he said the one thing that you do really notice is that if you put the two sets of data, so for example, all Tom Dumoulin's power files from the Giro versus his power files at the Tour, one thing you do see is these consistent big jumps in power, which correspond to accelerations throughout stages and throughout the 3 weeks of the race. So you'll go, riders will frequently go from 100 to 600 watts in the course of a race. And this has a big effect on fatigue over the course of the race. And Hendrik said that last year at the Tour de France and the Giro, the total workload of the two races, the kilojoules were almost identical, but it was very different, the distribution, how much energy was expended in each stage and in each sort of phase of each stage. So that was kind of interesting, and SunWeb I know have done, or they do a lot of work with, I think it's KPMG who have developed software for them, which helps them to model these races and the courses, and they can literally sort of overlay a rider's characteristics on top of a course and of a profile, and presumably it's with the help of tools like that they've made this decision.
Yeah, that's interesting little juxtaposition there with the image of I have of Demula checking his phone in Nepal and almost making an emotional decision rather than an evidence-based decision. Clearly the team then had to approve it and there were further discussions, but you do get the sense, don't you, that there was, we've seen it from Dumoulin before in races, a slight fit of pique, you know. Sod you, I'll go back to the Giro, because I'm sure the Tour would like Dumoulin to go to their race with that as his main focus. You know, he's a very, as we've said many times, he's very appealing star. He's got charisma, he's good looking, he's kind of what the sport needs in a lot of ways. So it is a bit of a slap in the face for the Tour, and you know, in contrast to what you say there about the, you know, all the kind of scientific data that goes into deciding a race program and a target, there does seem to be a bit of emotion involved in this too, and a positive emotion too, in the sense that he has talked about how much he loves the Giro and enjoys it.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, he did say, didn't he, that his heart is very much in Italy and with the Giro. Obviously, he's going to go to the Tour de France afterwards, but he's pretty pessimistic about doing well there, not least because there is 1 week less between the two races in 2019 than there was in 2018. But there does seem to be a fundamental sort of disconnect. If you look at the number of riders who have put their hand up for the Giro in 2019 and those that have put the hand up for the Tour, certainly, well, the field almost looks thicker at the Giro. And a lot of the reasons being cited for riders wanting to go to the Giro rather than the Tour is that they think it's going to be a less controlled race, and basically they've got more chance of breaking what they have perceived to be Sky's stranglehold on the race. And that is completely, that really jars with everything we're hearing from ASO and Christian Prudhomme when they announced the Tour de France route in October. They think that they're designing routes, and particularly this latest route for 2019, that will do precisely that. That will help to break one team, Sky's stranglehold, and this sort of defensive way of riding. But the coaches and the riders are looking at it and thinking that it's going to do the absolute opposite. And I just wonder whether the teams and the riders are looking at the routes in a very scientific way, and they're breaking the routes down in more forensic detail and with more insight, and whether ASO and the Tour de France are sort of basing their ideas on kind of old dogmas and just sort of presumptions, maybe based on what cycling has been like in the past.
I guess most presumptions are based on what's happened in the past, aren't they? And I mean, Primoz Roglic is a similar case in a way to Dumoulin. You know, rode very well at the Tour de France, just missed out on the podium in 2018, but isn't going back, or may go back, but he'd ride the Giro first and really target that. And again, he's a strong time trialist, and maybe looking at the time trials that Giro is favouring him. But then there are other riders like Simon Yates, who's not likely to be attracted by the time trialing, and yet is also going back to the Giro. And again, it seems to be an emotional connection or unfinished business that he has there that seems to be drawing him back. So, but as you say, it's a very interesting field assembling for the Giro, and a kind of equal mix of talent between the Tour and the Giro. But I have to say, Dumoulin in 2018 was also very pessimistic about his chances at the Tour, having ridden the Giro, and then finished second. So I take that with a bit of a pinch of salt, I think.
I mean, I think the basic premise, Rich, the basic presumption that all of these guys, Dumoulin and others, and Roglic and Simon Yates, they seem to make when they see a route with not much time trialing, is that it's going to be ridden defensively, and Sky are going to control it, and you're not going to see many attacks. You're not going to see the race sort of decant before the last climbs, and that's partly because, you know, a lot of riders on courses like that still feel as though they've got a lot to gain until very late in the stage and very late in the 3 weeks. So, you know, they're not going to show their cards. And we've talked about it before. You know, there are so few riders in the peloton now, or so few contenders at Tour de France, for whom a podium place would not be life-changing and career-changing. So they will defend a third place or a fourth place or a fifth place. And you know, that's in contrast, I think, to the Giro, where, you know, if you give Tom Dumoulin a two-minute advantage by virtue of a time trial, then it forces everyone else to sort of come out from their shell, come out of their shell early on, and that creates all kinds of chaos and it creates excitement. So, you know, in a way, it seems contradictory that Dumoulin would want to go into a situation like that where the race isn't controlled. But I think he feels, and probably other people feel, that Sky are better at controlling than Sunweb would be.
You spoke to his coach, Dumoulin's coach, Hendrik Werner, as well, didn't you?
I did, Rich. Let's hear from Hendrik, shall we?
Well, we have some people in the background who calculate and made all kind of estimations about the course, about the time trial kilometers, about the climbing percentages, and about his abilities, where they would fit the best, like just physically. And what we also learned from last year is, like, yeah, already focusing on this and also take this benefit with him to the Tour also gave something, like, adaption wise, and it worked pretty well. So we had a good experience with it. And the course suited much, much better in the Giro this year. Or much, much better. It suited better. And he has quite some love for Italy and also for the course. And that's when he said, like, well, if I really think about it, I would be up for the same option like last year.
I was talking to a rider at Katuja a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about this phenomenon now with riders of, they look on Strava and they look on even Instagram and they're more aware of what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
And they develop almost a paranoia and anxiety. Do you find that sometimes?
Yeah, I had the same. I said this in the last team. There were also some riders really looking for that. So basically, if you want to get better in something, if you want to get better in your interviews here with me, if you want to get better in doing a presentation or something, but you have to increase your readiness, but that you are open also for failures. So you have to switch from performance zone in races, where you do everything right, where you eat the right amount, where you do everything right, and you don't bonk, yeah? And in learning zones, so that means you are ready to also tolerate mistakes, but you're also, like, on purpose getting too hot, bonk in the end, don't eat enough, yeah? Basically, you have to get your system out of comfort, that the system reacts with the adaption, and for this sometimes you have to switch from this performance to this learning zone. And that's definitely something with Strava I saw, that, you know, that all this is visible and you tend to train more in gray zones, because, you know, like, okay, there's an average speed you can see later, there are people seeing how fast you ride the climb and so on, so probably you don't allow yourself to ride 20k per hour somewhere and enjoy a view, or to do the recovery just a little easier, but you pull it just a little bit more, or the time where you really want to do it easy, you probably also go for numbers or go for, yeah, or probably you don't also allow, and that was what I was talking with the bonking, that you don't allow your heart rate to buff, to explode and go through the roof, so that you do everything right and probably don't get the same adaptions then without, right, using Strava, yeah. if you want to show transparency and also want to share what you're doing, then it's all good. But the moment you start and doing this in comparison to others, then you're on the wrong track.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. Again, very grateful to them for their long-term support. And you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Before the break there, we heard from Hendrik Werner, the coach to Tom Dumoulin at Sunweb and one of the coaches at Team Sunweb. And what he said about, well, Strava and riders clocking what other riders are doing, and this sort of level of transparency that there is if riders are on Strava and even on social media and Instagram and so on. I mean, I think this question of yours, Daniel, came about from a conversation you had with Ian Boswell. Is that right?
It did, Rich. And this phenomenon of, I'm going to call it Strava Noia. Of basically
like it.
Looking closely at observing other people's training, particularly over the winter, and getting into a bit of a tizz about it and thinking that you're not doing
more. We're all guilty of that, though, aren't we?
And they're not doing more. And yeah, and as Hendrik says, it actually can be quite an obstacle and inconvenience for someone like him, who's a coach, who's setting people specific exercises to do, specific types of training, and in some cases in the past with him, he says they've been guilty of trying to, but basically keep up appearances on Strava, not doing the exercises, and making sure that they're maintaining a decent speed, or making sure they're going for KOMs, King of the Mountains.
It's why I'm not on Strava. I don't want people to see how little I'm doing. But I am on Strava, but I never turn it on because I really don't want to be judged for.
But it was also something, Rich, that I remember Bernie Eisel mentioned to me at the start of last year, just about the use of social media by pro riders. That, you know, even a picture on Instagram of someone, you know, having a coffee, you know, with a big hot chocolate with whipped cream. It can be used, or it could conceivably be used as ammunition against a rider by
or bluffing,
his coach
or bluffing. It could be bluffing.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But it does. It puts what I thought was sort of paranoia, Stravanoia, by Team Sky a few years ago into a slightly new perspective for me, because when there was a lot of you know, noise around Team Sky's refusal to release power data or, you know, training data, I kind of wondered why they were so protective of that data, and really what the big deal was. I think I kind of understand it a bit more now as this stuff's become more ubiquitous, that you know that these are writers' kind of trade secrets, I suppose. And while the transparency is fantastic, I can understand why some writers would want to keep this stuff quiet.
Yeah, I would agree. And another thing that comes up in conversation with riders, and particularly older riders now, is how focused the younger generation is on kind of dissecting and studying and poring over their training data. I mean, that was another thing that Ian Boswell mentioned to me, that some of the younger riders, like Katusha, will, at a training camp, they'll come back from the group training ride and they'll spend pretty much the rest of the, well, they'll spend hours thereafter going through power files and comparing notes on what they've done, what they've not done. Interesting little tidbit as well, in an interview I read in Pro Cycling Magazine with Chris Froome a couple of months ago, about how one big change with him last year as his salbutamol case was rumbling on, was that instead of coming back from training and really having a deep dive into his figures from the day's session, what he was doing was talking to lawyers on the phone. And he saw this as symptomatic of how he slightly lost focus on his training last spring.
Yeah, I noticed that nugget as well. I thought that was really interesting. you know, it wasn't just that case was on his mind. It was practically, you know, taking a lot of time and attention away from the recovery and the stuff that you would do after a training ride. That was really interesting, I thought. Yeah. I mean, you spoke to other people at Team Sunweb while you were there, Daniel, and a few changes at that team. Nicholas Roach is in and Jan Bakkelandse is in. He's come from AG2R. And on the coaching staff, Tom Wheeler's former rider has moved on as well. Brian Stevens, who joined the team last year, is still there and has quite an important role, certainly helping Michael Matthews there. But anyone else? I mean, I think you spoke to Nicholas Roach, didn't you?
I did, Rich. Before we hear from him, yeah, just on that, the change of personnel. I mean, we've talked about it before at Sunweb. They have this mantra of keep challenging, and it's very much the view of the team principal, Ivan Speckenbrink, that people have to continually be moving out of one comfort zone and, always challenging themselves. And I think some people have fallen by the wayside from that team because the team has felt they've not been doing that anymore. So yeah, as you say, there are a couple of changes in the coaching staff. They've also got a new head of R&D, which is a job title which I'm not sure exists in many teams. The individual occupying that position, I think, is Pete Royakkers, who used to ride for Skill Shimano. But yeah, a few changes in the riding staff as well. I mean, Bakkelandse and Roach, I suppose, could be seen as direct replacements for Laurens ten Dam and Simon Geschke, two experienced riders who have been with the team for a long time, and it is a very young team, and presumably Sunweb felt that they needed to add a bit of experience. So Roach and Bakkelandse have come on the staff. I did speak to Nicholas Roach about what led to him choosing Sunweb and what his role is going to be in 2019 and what his vision of his career is beyond 2019 as well.
I wanted to be still with be able to ride in support of a rider that could win the Tour or win a Grand Tour again. And I think, like I said, this team, in a way, offered the perfect spot where, you know, I realized today that I'm not as young as before. I still believe that I can still pull out some good performances over the year. Last year was a bit exceptional. I had a lot of things going on in my personal life, and I kind of paid the price on the bike. But that's a page that I've turned now, and I think this year, having this established role of being a rider that's there to share his experience, to be there in support of a top rider, and get a chance, it's like, you know, for me, it's an optimal role.
And you've been in a lot of different teams, a lot of different types of environment now, from AG2R to Sky to BMC. I mean, what have you kind of come to a firm conclusion about what kind of environment suits you best? Who the kind of people you need to be working with, how they need to treat you?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, over the years, like you said, I've been in teams where, you know, you have freedom, other teams that are really controlled, other teams where there's a bit of both. I realize what suits me is the more organized, the better. I feel that having that pressure of constantly reporting, of constantly being demanded things and all that kind of helped me to keep me focused even more.
You'll get that here, won't you?
Yeah, exactly. I was told, you know, it's like, in the peloton, it's like, Sunweb is like, you know, back in school and military and all that.
A lot of admin.
Exactly. And but, you know, the admin, if I was 20 and a rebel, I'd say, admin stuff, why do I have to lose 20 minutes a day filling this, and why send 5 emails for this and that? Like I said, going through the years of my career, I realized that when it's organized, it just makes your life so much easier. And younger, I spend so much energy and losing so much energy through stress because things were not organized, that today, looking back, I totally, I'm just going to say, welcome an organized team, because at the end of the day, yes, it's a little bit more organization, but once you get that that routine going, it just makes your life so much easier, and you don't need to stress about things as much as when things are not kind of sorted out for you. I'm not ready to retire yet. A couple of years ago, I said I wanted to go till I was 40. I might look back at that.
35?
34.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I won't. I don't think I'll make it till 40. But ideally, I would like to do 3 to 4 years. You know, it's just I just love this work too much, and I'm mentally I'm not ready to give up on cycling yet.
Have you got a plan for after?
I have a few things going on. You know, I have a little distribution company with a friend of mine in Ireland, where we distribute some of the main brands in the cycling business. So, you know, I haven't quite pushed to develop that, and my friend is kind of looking after that in Ireland, and we're slowly but surely growing it. I've also invested from my best friend from school in London in a restaurant in the city. So,
what kind of food?
It's a healthy takeaway office food. So it's your, you know, it's called Little Farm. So if you look at it on Instagram, it's mainly, you know, like your free range chicken with a bit of a white rice and broccoli. We're not going into the fancy stuff. It's quite efficient. You know, you have your porridge, your soup, and it's quite a. But we went for the healthy option. We didn't go for organic because organic, you know, it's a label. It's sometimes also scares people. And you know, being in the city, we're quite a. Our main goal is business lunch, so we need to be quick and healthy, and it works. Now, you know, we use all 100% recyclable dishes and all that, so it was just a nice little project.
Nicholas Roach there. I mean, what strikes me listening to Nicholas Roach is his enthusiasm. He's 34 now, as he said, and he's been around lots and lots of teams. Maybe that's one way of keeping it fresh, but he doesn't seem like a guy who is going through the motions, certainly, you know, in conversation. He sounds full of enthusiasm and still, you know, still talking about getting his chances in some races, but also being quite motivated by, you know, helping other riders.
Yeah, Rich, and to hear him there talk about doing 4 more years potentially, yeah, that surprised me slightly, but it's interesting. At the end of last year, particularly at the Vuelta, where he rode the Vuelta for BMC, there was this, just being around BMC, you kind of got the sense that there were a few riders there who had been sort of burned by the whole thing, the sort of slow death of BMC, and they'd lost a bit of enthusiasm, lost a bit of impetus, and that might then, or in some cases, was reflecting on the way they felt about the rest of their career. And Nicholas Roach wasn't one of them. It's going to be interesting to see what sort of job he does somewhere. He said there that he's sort of been penciled in for the Tour de France if everything goes well. I mean, they're going to have a good team at the Tour de France. Sam Omen is going to do the Tour, and Wilco Kelderman is also down to do the Tour de France. I understand Wilco Kelderman was originally slated to do the Giro as a leader. Then Tom Dumoulin decided that he wanted to do the Giro as well. So Kelderman now is potentially going to be a domestique in both the, or a domestique deluxe in the Giro and the Tour de France, which for a guy of his stature, where he is in his career at his age, that might seem like, a bit of an anticlimax, maybe.
Well, Daniel, before we go this week, we have launched our Friends program for 2019. It was launched before Christmas. Thanks to everyone who signed up as a friend of the podcast. We have launched with our audio diaries from the three Grand Tours and the Women's Tour. So Giro, Tour, Vuelta, and the Women's Tour. And they're all available now. The Vuelta diaries just come out. Each episode is over an hour long, and all the kind of stuff that didn't make it into the podcast, and some of the stuff that did make it into the podcast, but it's all there. And thanks very much to those who signed up and for your feedback so far in those episodes. That gets our 2019 Friends program up and running. There'll be more episodes to follow very soon, including my special from the Jumbo Visma camp just before Christmas. But you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. That's thecyclingpodcast.com. It costs £15 for the year, or you can pay more if you are feeling generous. And if you fancy submitting an idea to be a guest editor of an episode this year, you can do so if you pay a little bit more. So thank you very much, as I say, everybody who has signed up. And we'll be back next week with an episode focused on the world's winningest team. Can I use that term? De Koninck Quick Step. Lionel will obviously confirm the pronunciation, but that will be coming next week. He's got lots of interviews from there. I know he also had a long sit-down interview with Patrick Lefebvre, which will feature as a French special as well, and some interesting stuff from there, looking back on his life in cycling. And I think, Daniel, you're working on a French special as well, are you not?
Are you trying to put pressure on me?
No, not at all.
Yeah, I am.
Oh, no details.
That should be ready.
No details.
Should be ready by 2024.
Excellent. Well, there's an incentive for people to keep signing up year after year. No, it's. I think it's quite imminent, isn't it? And looking forward to hearing that one. No details, obviously, forthcoming from Daniel at the moment, but we'll tease them out of him over the next few weeks. So we've got back in the weekly rhythm. Tour Down Under starts next week, doesn't it? Are you ready for some racing, Daniel?
Napalm's favourite race, of course. Yes. Am I ready for some racing? Yes, Rich. No more of the indoor, the cross country.
No, there's still cross country. There's still a bit of cyclocross to come this year, the World Championships. We'll have to do something on the cyclocross as well at some point before.
Well, we established last year that we like cyclocross, didn't we?
Yeah, we did a little mini-series, and we'll do something from cyclocross this year as well, but we're not sure what yet, but that will come. But that's all for this week. We'll play out with an excerpt from one of those audio diaries from the Grand Tours from last year. We'll play out with that. But for the moment, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
I managed to accidentally park in the wrong place and lose my press accreditation this morning. I search everywhere in the car for it and start to wonder whether I can cover the remaining 3 days of my Vuelta stint as a rogue, unofficial outsider rather than bother the staff in the press office for another pass. Fortunately, it's a very low-key start, with a tiny crowd of people and no barriers keeping the public away from the team buses, so I'm able to do what I'd normally do, although I feel somewhat naked without my official Vuelta pass and lanyard. I tick off a few people on my hit list for an episode of Kilometre Zero we're making on cycling's transfer market. It's always struck me how dysfunctional the market is. Depending on the circumstances, sometimes the riders hold the upper hand, but most often it's the teams who call the shots. Every August, when riders and teams are allowed to begin announcing their plans for the following year, it feels a little like a game of musical chairs. As we've seen with the Richie Port transfer from BMC Racing to Trek Segafredo, sometimes a team's future hinges on the destiny of one particular rider. Often riders are competing in the last of the season's Grand Tours, the Vuelta, knowing they're riding out their notice period with their current teams too. When Daniel and I discuss the way the transfer market works for the podcast, I indulge another of my flights of fancy, suggesting a week of the season when the transfers are announced one after the other, with all the drama and razzmatazz of the NFL or NBA draft.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.